This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and since you find us on the podcast, we know you are discerning listeners. Let's get to it. Here's today's show. For some adopted children, it is a life struggle to find out who they came from. The birth mother and blood father can tell a story about health history. It can fill in details about the curious whys and whats that distinguish each of us. Across the country, states who granted birth certificates to adopted children have honored the wishes of birth parents to remain anonymous. But Ohio made a change recently to allow all people adopted between 1964 and 1996 to access their original birth certificates after first giving all birth parents in the state the chance to stay anonymous. Beth Miller is an adoptee in Ohio who is hoping this change can help her find her birth father. She was one of the first adoptees to file paperwork requesting her original birth certificate, and she joins us from my hometown of Dayton, Ohio. Beth Miller, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
How important is this, and how much of a fight have you had to engage in to get the statistics and the details that connect you with your birth parents?
Well, to be honest with you, the events of the last week have been a little unreal because it's been so difficult for as long as I can remember. I've been looking for as long as I've known I'm adopted.
And what's your reason for wanting to know your birth parents?
Well, the reason has changed throughout the years. Before I had my son, a big part of the reason was wanting to know my medical history. I was unable to get any information at that time. A lot of it is just having that missing sense of where you came from. You have no background, no nationality information, certainly no medical information.
And do you have or did you have a suspicion of the kinds of people your parents were?
No, and I think that's one of the things that happens in the adoptee scenario is that there are a lot of stories that are told and a lot of myths, I guess you could call them, or the story of adoption that adoptees are told to just accept the fact that they are special because they were chosen to be adopted. And I think that's to sort of soften the ruffled feathers of, you know, that shock, if you don't know already, of being found out that you're adopted. Or in my case, where I was always told that. So it was never a shock of finding out that I was adopted. But there is definitely, you know, just to be expected that there's some shaming of the birth parent and there's some expectation on the adoptive parents to sort of make everything okay and pretend like they're not adopted, that they're one of the family, which is very well intended, but it still smooths over the reality.
And the story that you're told, of course, is that the birth parents, in most cases, want to remain anonymous. They don't want to connect with you. And for whatever reason, the law supports that, or at least did until this change in the state of Ohio. What do you think the reason was that your parents wanted to stay anonymous?
I don't know that they wanted to necessarily. I think there's an assumption as a part of the upbringing and the expectation, because there's a huge what if, because what if your parents have some horrible circumstances that you, after you find them, you wish you hadn't found out.
Right.
What if there was a circumstance where, you know, you have this fear of, well, we didn't want you, you know, that kind of, again, rejection. You've already been, quote unquote, somewhat rejected of, you know, they didn't want you, which at the bottom line is true, but they were always extenuating circumstances. So it's also equally possible, as I saw many people in Columbus, that they've wondered every day and every day that it's your birthday and when there are major holidays and when it's Mother's Day or Father's Day, that it's something that's always in their mind. That's also a possibility. There are possibilities of siblings. There are possibilities of, you know, life-changing medical conditions that you have no idea what's out there. So in my instance, I was able to find out because I had found my birth mother that on her side of the family, there's a strong instance of breast cancer, skin cancer, and type 2 diabetes.
What's your suspicion of the circumstances around the time you were born between your father and mother?
Well, I know that both my mother and my birth father, they were both active in the theater at Kent State University at the time. I was born on October 1st, which if you do the math, that was probably a New Year's Eve party. So that's my guess. But they were both in college and, you know, having a little girl when they weren't dating at the time, it probably was not in the cards.
What's the best case scenario that the Ohio records, the state records, and this change in the law can deliver for you?
I guess in my case, the answer to the questions that I've wanted for so many years, which is, where did I come from? Who did I come from? And what does that mean in the big picture of who I am?
And, you know, maybe your mom ought to give that to you.
Oh, I think that would be great if she would. But again, I try to look at this from the perspective of how would I want to be communicated with if I was in her shoes and be
Right.
very empathetic to her feelings and her scenario. I don't know who knew she was pregnant. I don't know who knew she gave up a child for adoption.
Well, you're very sensitive and you're obviously very determined. And this law in the state of Ohio is certainly giving you some tantalizing clues, but not the whole story.
Correct.
I'm struck that you're aware that they were in the theater at Kent State University. If someone came from Kent State and turned out to be a very successful and well-known actor, you can imagine why your birth mother wouldn't want to say anything about it.
Oh, that's entirely possible. I actually hadn't thought about that. I do have, looking at them right now, there's a stack of papers on my desk that are photocopies of every playbill that my birth mother ever acted in at Kent State while she was there. And I'm cross-referencing all of the gentlemen who were co-actors with her, who were also in the Thespian Society because she was in that. So that at least helps me narrow the pool. I also know that, I've got some physical characteristic information about him and about his interests and his background. My paternal grandfather was an architect. My father was 6'2", 180 pounds, fair, green eyes, and had gone to Kent, moved in 67, I think, to California, and had been admitted to the London Academy of the Arts. So there can't be that many people who went to Kent in theater and then went on to go to the Royal Academy of the Arts in London. That seems to me like it would be a small number of people. But it's getting to, people who worked in the Kenley Players where he acted and talking to people at the Cleveland Playhouse where he acted and talking with the archives people at Kent State and just trying to put all those things together.
Well, it's a great story, Beth,
Well,
and
thanks.
we don't want to hurt anyone's feelings, and we don't want to just, turn the story into a reason for treading on people's emotional weak points. But
Right.
I admire your determination and your sensitivity here, and good luck.
One of the things that adoptees have always said is, take my feelings into consideration. Take a thought or two about how this has affected me personally and emotionally and psychologically throughout the years.
Beth Miller, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Beth Miller, an adoptee in Dayton, Ohio, trying to find information on her birth father through her original birth records.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
For Nelson Mandela, imprisoned for years, who fought his oppressors in South Africa all his life to become that nation's president, there was never any time for rest. Quote, I have taken a moment here to rest, to steal a view of the glorious vista that surrounds me, to look back on the distance I have come, but I can rest only for a moment, for with freedom come responsibilities, and I dare not linger, for my long walk is not yet ended. That is the last line Mandela, who his people called Madiba, wrote to end his autobiographical account of his years as leader of South Africa, years that began in 1994.
Fellow South Africans, the people of South Africa, this is indeed a joyous night. Although not yet final, we have received the provisional results of the election. My friends, I can tell you that we are delighted by the overwhelming support for the African National Congress.
Mandela's long walk to freedom under apartheid is chronicled in his book of the same name, but his second book about his years of freedom and leadership was never finished, but it is due to be released posthumously next year. The book, still in production, relies on 25,000 words Mandela wrote in archive materials compiled and organized by his editor. With us now is Vern Harris, Director of Research and Archive at the Nelson Mandela Foundation. Vern, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, John. Great pleasure.
So what will this book consist of? What kinds of stories are in there? What will be his and what will be compiled from the archives?
Well, we're about halfway into the project, so difficult to be absolutely clear on that. It's going to be a hybrid, of course, part autobiography and part more of a biography, I would say. But we'll make it very clear where he's speaking in his own voice and where we're interpreting him.
Is he happy as president? Is he speaking candidly of challenges as president? Are there frustrations associated with becoming the leader of a country that he so longed to be free when he was in prison?
Yes, I think you've named a few important dimensions of this book. He started the manuscript with a long reflection on autobiography and a reflection on the extent to which he has been mythologized. And I think what he wanted to do with this book was to show a human being in a leadership position grappling with the major challenges of, on the one hand, finding reconciliation, but also of making democracy stick. I think he was very proud of his accomplishments, but he wanted to share more of the inner workings of cabinet, of government, and so on.
What will people value most from this book, do you think, those who have read his first book?
I think what stands out for me, it's hard to know how audiences around the world will respond to it, but what stands out for me is a fresh perspective on him as leader of the country. The dominant narrative is that he concentrated on reconciliation, that he left governance largely to the team he had assembled around him. But what we are seeing here is that he took a great interest in the day-to-day workings of government, and that particular issues, he was nuts and bolts involved.
A narrative of healing and a narrative of governance, certainly a major publishing event, the publishing of the second volume of the autobiography of Nelson Mandela. Vern Harris is Director of Research and Archive at the Nelson Mandela Foundation. Thanks so much, Vern.
Great pleasure.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Tell me your zip code, and I'll tell you how likely you are to be obese, out of shape, or at risk for heart disease. That's the idea behind a vast new data set on health assembled by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. They've determined that the county you live in can have a tremendous impact on your overall health. The 2015 County Health Rankings Report is out today. Michelle Larkin, the interim vice president of program portfolios at Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, joins me to discuss the findings. Ms. Larkin, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi.
How hard is it to assemble data like this, and how much is health by association, guilt by association?
So the data comes from a bunch of different data sets that are available and provide data on almost every county in the United States. So it's a major undertaking, but what we take away from it is that we really decided to do it because good health is about our medical care, but it's about so much more than that. It's about all the things that go into making us healthy or unhealthy, like education, transportation, housing, unemployment. All of those things come together to help determine whether we live long and healthy and prosperous lives.
If we live in a county that's ranked low, is it more difficult for us to have a healthy life? Or are we just, you know, an outlier in our among our own neighbors?
We like to say to people, the rank is really a starter of a conversation. It's not the entire conversation. So you have to dig in. So I would encourage listeners to go to countyhealthrankings.org to dig into the county that they live in or work in to say, how are we doing?
How does this data reflect a shift in strategy that communities need to take health into consideration as part of the overall quality of life, and that if everyone is behaving in a healthy manner, it improves the health for individuals all over the community?
What we're seeing is communities that are struggling with high school graduation are recognizing that that means that they have a less educated workforce, which means that it's harder for them to attract or retain business, because they not only need a healthy workforce, they need a well-educated workforce, and those things are really linked if we're talking about both individual health, the health of our families, and the health of our communities.
Is income inequality a determinant of health based on your data?
That's one of our new measures this year. And when we first started releasing the rankings in 2010, we were asked by counties to say, we really want to dig in and look at the differences. Income is absolutely a predictor of health. It helps us afford medical care when we're sick, helps us afford a safe place to live, and also helps to ensure that our schools are well-resourced. So the income inequality measure allows communities to go in and see how their community is doing and dig into the different populations and pockets to be able to start that conversation and ensure that we're thinking about all of the populations and engaging all of the populations within a county. We also know that there are some critical steps to take to ensure health. One is investing in education, thinking about how we prioritize job training and connect job training with education so that, again, as we attract business in, we have the workforce to be able to fill those jobs.
Well, we are all invited to take a look at our health in our communities by taking a look at this data from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Michelle Larkin is the Interim Vice President of Programs and Portfolios at Robert Wood Johnson. Next week, we at The Takeaway are launching a series that's going to look at some of the big health problems in different communities in America.
When I came in for my asthma, they gave me steroids, so that makes my diabetes higher.
The dentists are overwhelmed. There are just not enough dentists to serve the population.
My mom called, and she just started screaming, "Your sister's dead, your sister's dead."
That's just the beginning of our conversation. Sound pretty interesting, huh, Michelle?
It does, and I think it's so important to have access to providers and to engage the leaders from business, faith groups, healthcare, all of those folks have a role to play in building that culture of health for our nation.
Well, and that's what we plan to do together with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the American Communities Project. We'll visit five counties to explore the problem areas and the innovators working to address them. That's next week on The Takeaway. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Takeaway is supported by Moo, offering a variety of business cards and printed products. Moo also offers Printfinity, the ability to print a different image on every card. More at Moo.com.
Here's a very personal question that some of you may have grappled with on your own. Why would someone elect to have major surgery if they are healthy, with only the possibility of developing cancer at some point in the future? Well, some mothers are deciding that the decision is as much about the quality of life for their children as it is for their own quality of life. Allison Gilbert, author of Parentless Parents, How the Loss of Our Mothers and Fathers Impacts the Way We Raise Our Children, joins me now. Allison, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Describe the decision you made and how it relates to your anticipation of the quality of life of your own children.
It was wrenching, and it wasn't quick. My mother died when I was pretty young. She died in 1996, and I was only 25, so I wasn't married. I just barely got out of college and was just launching my career, so everything felt very fresh and new, and I needed her. And so she
right.
died right when I was beginning. And right then and there, her surgeon told me that I should have my ovaries removed when it was time, when I was done having my own family. So I knew about the options really early. So as soon as the
test— These are genetic proclivities, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly. So BRCA1 and BRCA2 mean statistically you're far more likely to develop breast and ovarian cancer than the general population. And the stats are staggering. It's not just a little bit more likely. It's a lot more likely. And with BRCA1 in particular, the onset is also when you're younger. And if you get it, it's much more aggressive. And so BRCA1, which is the same mutation that Angelina Jolie has as well, the consequences are grave. And so I didn't rush into it. I took more than 10 years to really grapple with what to do about it. And I ultimately decided to have my ovaries taken out. It was really important for me to look at my kids and know that I did everything I could to stay alive for them as long as possible. I don't think if I didn't have kids, I would have done it. But it's for them. It's ensuring as much as I can that I'll be there for them.
Well, Angelina Jolie Pitt has a whole raft of children, and here she is talking about her decision to have her breasts removed.
I'm very, very well. I feel very happy that I made the choice I made, and
yeah.
and I'm And I will follow up with the other surgery at some point because my mother had breast and ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
So she clearly is following the same path that you followed, breasts, then ovaries, and now I'm preparing myself to be a mother well into my children's adulthood.
It's actually very interesting. I took an opposite approach in terms of when I had my surgeries, mm-hmm. which is just really important to talk about. I falsely thought that the removal of my breasts would actually impact me to a far greater extent. I thought it would impact my how I viewed myself, mm-hmm. how the world viewed me. That's an external process that I was really grappling with. And so I actually did that second. The ovaries to me was the lower hanging fruit. To me, the surgery was much more simple, fewer complications. You're kind of in and out. It's done laparoscopically, so you don't really have scars. And I wasn't anticipating the fallout. And so to me, I did that first because, of course, the testing for ovarian cancer to make sure you don't get it is a little bit more difficult. Women are used to getting mammograms and sonograms for their breasts, and testing for ovarian cancer is far more, it's not more complicated, but it's less specific, so you don't really have those warning signs that you do, thank goodness, with mammograms. But just the opposite was true. The mastectomy was kind of the easy part. I didn't really have the ripple effects that I anticipated. It was just kind of over and done with.
Mm-hmm.
What Angelina Jolie talked about in her op-ed piece was going into menopause immediately. It's called surgical menopause. And I just didn't get it until you're in it.
And that was tough.
It's tough. It's tough. All the things that you would experience gradually and far older. I was 37. When you're in your 50s or 60s, you know, night sweats and mood swings and weight gain, all those things came crashing down because it wasn't slow. And it wasn't gradual. It was, you know, you woke up and you didn't have your ovaries, which of course means you don't have those hormones regulating those mood swings potentially, or your, you know, the ability to maintain a proper weight for that age. And it was harder than I ever would have anticipated. Yet, I'm so glad that I did it.
How important was your family's support in all of this?
That's a really good question. I think that I was programming myself to do it with or without their support. I felt very committed. I felt that I had done my research. I felt that the data supported my passion for taking ownership and not falling victim. It wasn't just my mom who died of ovarian cancer. It was my mom's mom. So it was my grandmother. It was my mom's sister, my aunt. These women, all three women in my life, died of breast or ovarian cancer.
So let's come back to that emotional moment when, as a 25-year-old, you lose that adult partner who's going to guide you through these difficult years of the 20s. You know you're going to be there for your children.
I didn't know I was going to be there. I wanted to be there. I passionately wanted to be there. And so I looked my kids in the eyes, and they're young, and I just couldn't imagine having the narrative be, well, I guess mom could have done something. And why didn't she? She could have been here today. And so those very morbid scenarios played out in my mind, and I was very aware of that thread for them. And I wanted them to know, I wanted their story to be, in case anything ever did happen to me, that she tried. She tried to do everything that she could so my children would know that they were the most important reason for me to do something that was really profound. This is not easy. These choices are difficult. I don't think Angelina Jolie or I, because I've written about this a lot, I don't think that we provide a tailwind. I don't think we're rushing other women to make choices that they're not comfortable with. What I think, I hope that I'm doing, and certainly I could never speak for Angelina Jolie, she's in a whole different orbit. But what I think, I hope that our words do is just give a vocabulary and provide the right words to have these discussions with your family. And then when you do talk to your kids about this, because I did talk to them about it in an age-appropriate way about what mommy was doing, and I wanted them to get it as much as they could at that age. And as they get older, particularly my daughter.
What are you going to do for her that your mom couldn't do for you?
My mom didn't have the options to test for BRCA. It didn't really come on the market until 1996, the year that she died. And so for my daughter, I would advise her to never wait, to be proactive.
And you'll be there to give her that advice.
Yes.
Allison, Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Allison Gilbert is the author of Parentless Parents, How the Loss of Our Mothers and Fathers Impacts the Way We Raise Our Children. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani is in Washington, D.C. to discuss a continued presence of U.S. troops in his country and to thank the president for a change in strategy announced this week that will maintain a troop presence for some time to come.
I've decided that we will maintain our current posture of 9,800 troops through the end of this year.
President Ghani believes there is a natural affinity that has developed between Afghanistan and those American troops.
Over a million American soldiers have served with Afghans. Over these years, they've gotten to know our remotest valleys, our deserts, our mountains, and the majority of them that I've encountered will tell you something that moves me to tears. They say they've left their hearts in Afghanistan.
Left their hearts in Afghanistan. That's President Ghani speaking to NPR's Renee Montaigne. Is that true? What does it mean? American vets feel they've left their hearts in Afghanistan, a powerful idea that goes beyond missing a tank or combat comrades. It's something we want to take a few minutes to explore. We're going to talk with Elliot Ackerman, who served five tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's the author of Green on Blue, and it's a novel, and he's an outspoken veteran of the war in Afghanistan. Elliot, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I spent a lot of time in Afghanistan. I remember the green of the Kabul River, the beauty of the mountains, the just warmth of the people there, the crazy stories that you would find in Kabul of people surviving on all kinds of entrepreneurial sort of scenarios amidst all this violence. You were there far, far longer. Do you understand what President Ghani is talking about?
I certainly do. You know, when I talk to other vets, I think one theme that rings out is that, you know, Afghanistan is it's like an unreasonable place. You know, you're up in the northeast, the mountains are unreasonable. You go to the south, to the high plains, to the desert, the heat is unreasonable. The violence is unreasonable. The length of the war is unreasonable. And the Afghan people's ability to persist and in many ways find, you know, humor and optimism in it all seems, you know, seems incredibly unreasonable. And it's endearing. And I think that for many veterans of both who've served in both Iraq and Afghanistan, there's something about Afghanistan that captures the imagination.
What's the place for you? If your heart is some place in Afghanistan, where would that be?
I think the idea of, you know, one's heart being in Afghanistan is, you know, I feel very much that I'm sort of an expatriate of both countries. And I say that if you define the term expatriate, it's someone who's in many respects formed by a place that they'll likely never return back to or only return back to with great difficulty. And both in Iraq and Afghanistan, the battlefields there, you know, shaped me. You know, it's in many respects where I grew up, going off there in my 20s and returning back in my 30s. And so like any expatriate, my identity is informed by a place I'll likely never return to. And so I recognize that when they say, you know, a part of your heart is in Afghanistan. I don't think it's with sort of a romanticism, but I think it's, you know, an understanding that, you know, you've been defined by this place.
But in a sense of nostalgia and not cheap nostalgia, if we can posit, as President Ghani does, that there is some connection, emotional connection between Americans and Afghans that he clearly wants to build upon in some way, in some productive way. Can you imagine a scenario where you were dropped into Afghanistan and you had couple of hours to kill on a beautiful Saturday afternoon and in Kabul? Where would you go? What would you do? Who would you see? Where would it be?
Sure. Well, the you know, my novel is dedicated to two Afghan soldiers, Ali and Big Cheese. And Big Cheese was a guy who could get things done. His name was Aziz. So because he was a guy who could get things done, we quickly called him Big Cheese Aziz, which just evolved into the Big Cheese. So Big Cheese and I used to sit out in our fire base, which was, this was in Paktika province. I served around the country. This was in the southeast, right on the border with Pakistan, South Waziristan. And we would look out you know, at the mountains. And sometimes we would sort of begin to wax philosophic about what the world might look like in 10 or 15 years. And I'd say to him, you know, Z's, maybe someday I'll come back here with my family and there'll be like a ski resort up in these beautiful mountains. And he would sort of laugh. And he was a very sharp guy. I said, maybe you'll be the one who finds it and we'll call it Big Cheese Skis. And we go there together. And, you know, we were, you know, it was a little bit of a fantasy. But I think throughout history, you look at veterans from the Vietnam vets to the World War II vets, there's this idea of wanting to return and wanting to sort of commune with the ghosts of that place. And I don't imagine it will be that much different amongst my generation of veterans.
Do other veterans talk about this that you speak to?
They do. I think it's very difficult to make a blanket statement about all veterans, that all of them have left their hearts there. But there's certainly many I talk to who are friends who, you know, we discuss Afghanistan and what the future might be and how it might continue to inform our identity and our experience.
You know, there are authors, Sebastian Younger being one, the Three Cups of Tea fellow who mm-hmm. got into all sorts of trouble in his philanthropy. But nevertheless, an individual came to Afghanistan for one reason and decided to stay and do something else. Do you think that this sentiment, this idea of some sort of emotional connection between the millions of Americans who've served and the people of Afghanistan can build something productive besides an occupation, besides a sort of nation-building exercise that is so frustrating and militarily unresolvable?
Yeah, I certainly hope so. I mean, I was very much welcomed President Ghani's remarks, and I think they're a far cry from President Karzai's remarks and how he characterized U.S. troops. And I think it's a move step in the right direction if both sides, American and Afghan, can stop seeing one another as antagonists and maybe as partners, and not only rebuilding Afghanistan, but rebuilding what we have internalized as the American experience in Afghanistan.
No Afghan leader has spoken about, you know, the Russians losing their hearts in Afghanistan. So it seems to me a unique overture to the United States. Do you think of it that way?
Yeah, I think it does. I think that, I mean, obviously the Russian occupation of Afghanistan was much more bloody than the American experience there. I mean, 1 million Afghans were killed during the Soviet War. But, you know, I think we'll see. And if we look historically, you know, again, from Europe in the Second World War to Korea, you know, all these places where we fought these wars, the futures of both countries have been inexorably linked together. And I think that's going to be the case with the U.S. and Afghanistan. And we should move forward understanding that being so linked, we should do so with hopefully optimism.
So among others, it sounds as though the President Ghani was speaking about you, Elliot Ackerman.
Yeah, probably was.
Elliot Ackerman served 5 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's the author of the novel, terrific novel, Green on Blue. Thanks so much, Elliot.
Thank you.
So here's something to take with you today. Laura Dowling served for 6 years as chief floral designer during Obama's presidency. It all seemed rosy, and then something happened. Do you love conspiracy theories? I certainly do. According to the Washington Post, Dowling on Tuesday was escorted from the building on February 13th under circumstances that were at best vague and at worst mysterious. The Washington Post report was attributed to a source with close ties to current resident staffers. A source in the floral arrangement department of the White House. The day before Valentine's Day? Are you serious? So what happened? Did Michelle Obama hate a particular arrangement? Maybe President Obama preferred a certain strain of daffodil that wasn't being featured? Who gives daffodils on Valentine's Day? Anyway, Dowling issued a statement. After almost 6 years as chief floral designer at the White House, I have resigned in order to pursue exciting new opportunities and explore my passion for floral artistry. Yeah, that's pretty predictable. Who knows? The only thing we know is that while Dowling made it 6 years as queen of the White House flower, she didn't even get close to her predecessor, Nancy Clark, who held the job for 6 administrations. Tell us your story. Give us your floral arrangement for the president at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.